most recent or accurate amendments just arrived, so we're going to scratch that from our agenda for today until we rectify some of the issues. Also, Senate Bill 332 is not ready, so that one will not be heard today. We're going to begin work session on Senate Bill 136. And we have counsel, if you'll explain to us where we are and what we're doing with this thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. If you remember, Senate Bill 136 was a bill designed to give the Secretary of State discretion to refuse to accept wrongful filings so that the filings could be more standardized and so it could reduce the overall workload. We actually have three sets of amendments here, and if I could ask somebody from Secretary of State's office to come up and tell us which one they want to go with, dash 1, 2,
or
3.
Good morning. My name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office. Amendment 3, dash 3 amendment is the one that includes everything that was prior to that.
All right. So scratch number 1. Scratch number 2. We're looking at the dash 3. You want to share with us what they do?
Yeah. In Chairman Minnis, members of the committee. What we did since the hearing is we met with those parties that had concerns. In the Dash 3 amendment, it alleviates the concerns that the courts had about the appeals process, and it adds in the appeal would be through the contested case process. We also worked with the Oregon State Bar, the debtor-creditor section, as well as the business law section to alleviate the concerns that they had. And what we do through the bill is we narrow the scope of what the areas or the reasons for rejecting to just get to those filings that we had originally wanted, and it's basically where the debtor and the creditor are the same person, and it's a filing against themselves. What we do with those filings is we will index on our records in our database that there's a reject. We won't index the actual filing when it's rejected, but we will index that it was rejected. And by that, we'll be able to notify other potential junior filers that there's a filing out there, at least through the appeals process. So the initial appeals process would be 20 days. If the filer requests an appeal, then we would keep that notice out there throughout the length of the appeals process.
All right. Question, Senator Ringo.
Sure, I don't see in my stack of paper any dash amendments. I'm just wondering.
You should have them in your files, but let's make sure you do.
Thank you.
All right. So, Peter, let's again go through for me the process, assuming the bill passes. Someone comes in and files one of these records. It appears to be. What's the right word?
Chairman Minnis, members of the committee. So once if the bill becomes law, what would happen? Assuming that my hope is that these radical common law groups will just go elsewhere. Chances are they'll probably find some other mechanism to accomplish their means. But what we will do through the UCC system is if they come in and attempt to file, we will take the filing and reject it. We'll take and note that rejection in our database and provide them with a rejection notice that gives them 20 days to appeal the rejection. They can do that by giving us written notice and asking us to reconsider. The Secretary of State will then take that under reconsideration. If we uphold the rejection, then their next course of appeal is through the contested case process. if through the administrative law judge upholds the rejection, then they also have an appeals process through the Court of Appeals, and then that would be the final. At any time that the rejection was overturned, what we would do is we would go back to that original date of filing and reinstate it and make the filing active as of that date. So the UCC is a first-in, first-priority system, and that would help to accommodate any filers that might have been rejected inappropriately.
All right, great. Any questions? Everybody up to speed with where we're going on this thing? All right, Senator Walker.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say that we see this a lot in bankruptcy proceedings where these people have gone and filed claims against folks. So I appreciate that you're trying to resolve this. And the question that the chair had asked about the process has helped me kind of process that through my head. And I think I understand what's going to happen now. So thank you.
Right. And I think if I understand correctly, you don't have clear authority to do this now. And what the bill does is create that clear authority and a process that would be used for someone who...
Chairman Minnis, that is correct.
Right. Okay. Sounds normal or orderly to me. And sounds reasonable. Senator?
Mr. Chairman, this is the wrong approach to take with this kind of a problem. We should accept these filings with a filing fee of $10,000 paid in gold specie to the Treasury Direct Department for direct deposit under these account numbers.
All right, Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the -3 amendment.
Chair, I like Senator Perioli's idea, but I do move the -3 amendment.
Thank you very much. Any discussion on the adoption of the -3 amendments? There are none. Motion passes. Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 136 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick now moves Senate Bill 136 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? There is none. Motion passes. Senator Farioli, would you be so kind as to carry the bill?
That's an appropriate punishment, Mr. President, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Thank you. You can suggest your alternative for the House to consider.
Mr. Chairman, have an apple box on which I may stand in the free speech corner.
You'll have to get an exception from the rules so that you can use boxes. All right. So the next bill up is what?
255.
255. Council, what does it do?
If you recall, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 255 requires veterinarians to report cases of suspected aggravated animal abuse and establishes a fine for failure to do so. We have -1 amendments, which I understand are consensus amendments from all the parties.
All right. And can you explain, or should we have someone else explain respect to the amendments?
Why don't we have somebody else?
All right. Who's here to make sure? Who's here to share the amendments and what they do? And good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pardon me. My name is Marcia Keith. I'm with Dave Barrows and Associates, and here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. This is our proposed bill, and we had the amendments drafted after discussion with several parties who had some minor objections to the original bill. On page 1, the amendment clarifies that the Humane Society in Oregon and the municipal and county animal control agencies must employ sworn officers in order for them to be able to take the report of aggravated animal abuse. This was at the request of the Sporting Dogs Association, since it's a a felony crime, and they felt that sworn officers ought to be the ones responsible for taking the report. So we worked with them to secure that language, and the Humane Society as well was a part of that discussion, and they're fine with that language. I believe it was at the request of Senator Minnis that the word immediately was deleted from line 10. Required that someone immediately or that after the suspected animal abuse was reported that the law enforcement officers immediately take some action, and we just dropped the word immediately since it was didn't know whether immediately meant in the next 15 minutes or in the next week or and in line 21, I thought I had this bill memorized, actually, word for word, but I don't have the bill with me, and I can't remember what the material is in line 21 that's restored.
Page 2, line 21. Oh, you're just restoring the one.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
You're restoring the one because we're also restoring the delivery.
Oh, okay.
So
very good.
Section
okay.
Two, section 7.
And then the last part of the amendments restores the material that we had suggested be deleted, which was for veterinarians to report to the Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine any cases that they investigated of animals who were purported to have been injured in steel-jawed leg traps.
Okay.
And
thank
we're restoring those.
Committee, any questions or discussion?
Just one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Keith, why originally did you want to delete that last portion on 27 through 29?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, this was this language was a result of a bill that was passed in the 2001 session. Excuse me. And the issue that the veterinarians have with that particular procedure is that the reporting of those suspected injuries is perhaps done to the wrong agent, that the dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine may not be the correct person to report to. But we don't feel strongly enough about it to hold up this bill over it.
I think we had testimony from Jared Broadfoot, Al Elkins, Rod Harger.
Exactly. We did.
Supported maintaining the language
we
from the 2001 session. So.
Well, I missed that entire scintillating testimony, so it must have been gone.
Highly unusual. You don't miss anything.
No, it might be a few minutes late, but I'm never gone.
Right.
So thank you for clarifying that for me.
Any other questions, Senator Burry?
Mr. Chairman, are you in work session?
We are.
Mr. Chairman, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 255.
Senator Burry moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 255. Discussion? Is there any objections? There is none. Senator Burry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 255 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves. Senate Bill 255 is amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so in order. We'll ask Senator Schrader to carry the bill. If he does not, then I will carry it. Senate Bill 259, work session. Council, you're ready. Can you guys hear me out there? Okay, I'll try to speak up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 259 requires that a person requesting or inspection of public record first knows relates to a claim against the public body, notify the attorney for the public body. We do not appear to have any amendments on this.
Okay.
Up the work session, and
all right. I think we had a pretty broad discussion about this issue, and I think when we left it, there was some discussion about the use of this notification within the Attorney General's office. I assume that the members of the committee have been appropriately lobbied on the bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ringo?
Thank you. Just one question for sure. Committee counsel. I read the summary, except my recollection was that this applied after a lawsuit has been filed and that they have to notify the attorneys.
Okay.
I mean, the summary says notify the attorney for the public body.
It was my understanding that there didn't have to be a lawsuit filed.
Okay.
It was just the potentially relating to a claim. No, I'm kidding. Mixed signals from the audience. Maybe we could call somebody else.
Okay.
Mr. Landauer. And guest.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. If you could repeat the question, I apologize, Senator.
No, I was just wanting to clarify whether the notification requirement kicked in when a lawsuit was filed or any time there was a thought there might be a claim against the public body.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Ringo, I believe that it relates to the notice has to be given to the public body's attorney once the notice has been filed that a claim against that public body will be taken.
Right. So they file a notice for a claim.
That's correct.
Okay. Which is a potentiality, then that would kick.
And then the notice for any public records, requests, then the attorneys for that public body have to be notified about those public records requests. There was also a concern that the trigger, again, that the claim has to be filed before this requirement kicks in. Number one, and number two, there was a concern among the members at least in the City of Portland, there will be one person responsible for receiving this notice, and that individual will get that notice to the appropriate litigator within the office. So that was an issue.
Senator,
that was
I mean, the bill does say it applies when somebody's filed a tort claim notice or there's an action that's been filed. And I remember grousing a little bit about this during the hearing, but I'm fine with it.
There does not have to be a lawsuit.
Correct.
There could be a tort claim.
Could be a tort claim. Correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brewer.
And just to clarify the record, this does not apply to news media requests or requests for information by members of the public who just want to find out information. Is that correct?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, so long as they haven't filed a claim against that public body related to the public records that they're requesting, it would not apply.
Right. So I'm assuming if it's a normal public records request without a notice of tort claim or suit filed, then
we're under the obligation to release that information unless there's a specific exemption for us to release that information.
Right. And I assume if there's a disagreement and they haven't released the documents and a notice of tort claims then filed, then it would kick in.
Well, but Mr. Chairman, this bill does not deal with whether you need to release the records or not. Dealt with in other statutes.
That is correct.
What this deals with is who has to be notified when the requests are made.
That is correct.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments?
Mr. Chairman, just the assertion that the requirement occurs after a notice of intent to sue is filed, that the only document that goes from the records office to the appropriate city agency is a copy of the request form, and that there is somebody at the other end of the pipeline that will receive the request form in time to move it to the appropriate attorney's desk so they can make a decision as to whether or not they need to get the documents prior to the discovery process. I had some concerns that we were just creating another little blizzard of paper that never would find the file at the appropriate moment, and mm-hmm. that the whole thing is processed in the discovery
right.
anyway. But I'm sure that there is a needful purpose here. So I'll
and I assume if the government drops the ball once they've been noticed, that's their own fault or their own problem. So
that is correct.
All right. Everybody on the comfort? Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 259 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Right.
Isn't there an amendment?
There are no amendments.
Oh.
Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 259 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Additional discussion? Any objections? No objection? Motion passes. Senator Burdick, that's your bill. If you carry it.
I'd be honored, Mr. Chairman.
And we'll go to Senate Bill 397. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, if you recall, Senate Bill 397 establishes a three-year statute of limitations for civil actions based on shoplifting. The discussion that we had last time was on the removal of a retroactivity provision. That is what the Dash 1 amendments do. You'll see the Dash 2 amendments as well. I believe Senator Ringo had some concerns regarding statute of limitations issues as to whether it should be 3 years or something more. And I discussed that with legislative counsel, and we came to the conclusion that 6 years, which had been mentioned, was going to be probably too long. There were certain exceptions in the ORS, and it's my understanding that 2 years is just going to be too short. So the Dash 1 stick with the current three-year statute of limitations and simply remove the retroactivity clause. So it's my understanding that those are the ones we should go with.
All right. So, okay. And the conversion statute is the six-year?
Right. And the reason for that is that there's additional penalties for conversion that are not applicable here. It's just kind of a different statutory scheme, and it didn't seem appropriate to impose those same penalties in both of these situations.
All right. So the Dash 1 amendment is the
Dash 1 amendment is the applicable amendment.
All right. Senator Ringo, are you fine with that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, just a comment. My concern was that the statute of limitations for conversion is 6 years, and I guess I just want to make it clear that this does not change that in any way.
It does not.
All right. Senator Burry.
Chairman, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 397.
Senator Burry moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 397. Additional discussion? Is there any objections? There are none. Motion passes. Senator Burry.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 397 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burry now moves Senate Bill 397 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussions? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. My name appears on the bill, so I'll carry this. All right. That gets us to the public hearings on a series of bills. Yeah. I think we will. We'll do a public hearing on Senate Bill, excuse me, House Bill 2305, 2306, 2307, 2309. They're all related. Public hearing is now open. Mr. Neil Bryant, former member of the Senate. Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, distinguished chair of the Judiciary Committee, present.
Thank you. There's a little deja vu being back in this room. I was more comfortable at that end of the room, though.
Sorry, Pam, but that.
My name's Neil Bryant, and I'm an attorney from Bend, Oregon. And the 2001 legislature passed Senate Bill 104, which set up what we called the HIPAA Committee. And I was appointed as one of the representatives on that committee. There were 17 members, and there's a roster attached to my testimony that shows you who was appointed. And we met over 18 months to take a look at this federal law, and it's HIPAA. It's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996. And what brought the urgency upon the state of Oregon and all the states was approximately 300 pages of regulations that were adopted approximately 2 years ago. And those regulations and the implementation date are April 14th of this year. So that's why each of the bills has an emergency clause on them. The federal government indicates that they're not going to extend that implementation date, so other legislatures are acting expeditiously as Oregon. You have four bills in front of you, and just if I may touch on what their topics are and then who will present them from the committee. House Bill 2305, this is an individual has the right to have their protected health information called PHI safeguarded from unlawful use or disclosure, and has the right to assess and review their protected health information. Gwen Dayton from the Association of Hospitals and Health Systems will testify on this bill. House Bill 2306 establishes standards for health insurers that are subject to the information privacy provisions of HIPAA and also the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, another federal act. Len Hagen from Regents Group and Molly Burns Herman from Kaiser Permanente will testify on this particular bill. House Bill 2307 revises requirements for disclosure of or access of certain health information created and received by the Department of Corrections, Department of Human Services, and Community Health and Developmentally Disabled Programs or services to conform to a federal law regarding privacy of health information. Gwen Dayton, again, will speak on that. 2309 relates to the provisions of information by health care providers in certain law enforcement and court proceedings, and Gwen will also mention that. We have other members of the committee that are also here today that will be helpful if specific questions are asked. The committee met at their public meetings, naturally. Minutes were posted on the website. In addition to the 17 members, we had others in the audience that included a variety of people. We also worked with the Oregon State Bar and their associations dealing with health care issues. The reason I mention this was that in the House there was some question about the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and the fact that, they weren't on the committee. That wasn't our responsibility because we were appointed. We didn't select the committee ourselves, and the statute laid out what groups were to be there, and certainly they could have been appointed or a representative. The trial lawyers did have someone attend some of our meetings, so they knew what was going on, and they made recommendations in the House dealing with some definitional issues, and we have adopted most of those. You'll find in the amendments that are prepared today, but we still have some disagreement. The committee had to study what's known as the preemption issue. When a federal law passes, if it if it conflicts with a state law, generally that the federal law preempts. And so we did a preemption analysis and found that some of Oregon's laws are more protective than HIPAA, and in that case those laws continue and we haven't modified those. But in general, what you'll see that the bills have done is try to be consistent in the definitions and the terms which this massive federal regulation basically imposes on the states, so that when people ask about HIPAA and read the state statutes, they'll see consistent terms between the federal scheme and the state scheme. HIPAA privacy rules do the following. One, they define what protected health information is. They give patients more control over their health information. They set boundaries on use and release of health records and require patient authorization for use and release outside of those boundaries. They establish appropriate safeguards for health providers and others that others must achieve to protect private health information. They hold violators accountable with civil and criminal penalties if these rights are violated. It is our intent that the bills before you would create no new private cause of action. It strikes a balance when public responsibility requires disclosure of some forms of data, for instance, to protect public health. It enables patients to find out how their health information has been used when seeking health care services or reimbursement is received. It limits the release of health information to the minimum reasonably needed for the purpose of disclosure. This is most often in the collection agency. Or when you turn a claim into an insurance company, you can only give the insurance company that information that would justify payment of the claim. Or if it goes into collection, the collection agency who tries to collect for, say, the hospital could only have that information that's necessary to pursue the claim and no more. It gives patients the right to request restrictions on the use of their health care information. There are transaction standards. Those have already been implemented as of October 18th. And this is just so computer codes are the same when doctors and hospitals put information in. There are security standards that have already been implemented. As your committee looked at this, we thought we had three options. The first option would be to basically do nothing. And in that case, then, the practitioner, the insurance company, the patient would have to make their own determination between the federal law and the state law, inconsistent language, and determine which applies or if they're consistent or if it's preempted. We didn't think that was our purpose, and we didn't think we'd be doing anything for the state of Oregon by doing nothing. The second was we could just recommend that you adopt HIPAA and the regulations and create a new law or a series of laws that did that. But again, then you'd have the existing state law and the new HIPAA law and no clarification, at least from the legislature, is what you thought was preempted, and you'd have, again, two inconsistent terminologies between the existing state law and HIPAA. So the third is what you see before you today, where we thought we could add clarity, still protect privacy, and add efficiencies, and eliminate confusion, inconsistency, and conflict between not only the regulators and the carriers, but everyone else involved in our healthcare system. HIPAA is going to be very expensive to implement. It already is. And beginning April 14th, you're all going to receive letters asking for you to sign this disclosure release from your provider, from your hospital, or from your doctors. It's going to be probably a 3 or 4 page form, but that's going to be the new standard in the industry. And anytime you go in to seek health care, you're going to have another HIPAA disclosure request. So I wish I could bring to you something that's sexy and intriguing and something you can really sink your teeth in. You could if you wanted to, and we're here to answer the questions, but it's going to be a complicated, I'd say probably 4 or 5 years as the HIPAA rules are reviewed and states implement them, and we try to make sense of what's intended to be more or less a national policy. I suspect that the next legislative session there'll be a HIPAA 2 committee that'll come forward with some refinements or suggestions. And we went to other states and asked them what they're doing as our committee was meeting, and their general response was, let us know what you're doing, because their interim committees and their legislature really hadn't gotten into it yet, but they're certainly scrambling right now. So I think once again Oregon is taking the lead, but the deadline is April 14th. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would step aside and allow my colleagues to present if you wish and answer your questions.
All right. I would hope if this works to start with each bill and have someone go through them and tell us what was done and why it was done. And
we can do that. That's our intent.
Walk us through that if you would.
And the first then would be 2305 Wind 8.
Okay. Wait.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton, and I am counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, but I'm speaking to you today as a member of the Senate Bill 104 Committee and on behalf of the 104 Committee, and I realize I have some written testimony to let me. I'm going to talk to you today about House Bill 2305, the A. Engross version. And I will make an attempt to be brief, because as intriguing as HIPAA and its implementation in Oregon is to many of us who live and breathe it every day, we've been told that to the rest of you it is akin to some unique form of torture, or at the very least some insomnia device. So I will go through this, explain why we did what we did, and I hope you will ask questions if something is not clear. Just to let you know, my HIPAA manual back in the office that has the regulations and the commentary is 4 or 5 inches thick. And so explaining HIPAA in this context can be difficult, but we will do our best. First, House Bill 2305 really is at the core of the package of bills that you'll hear about today. It addresses ORS.
Which bill again?
2305.
Oh, okay. This room, for some reason, is hard to hear.
Well, and if I'm not speaking loudly enough, I will try to do better. Thank you. And let me know if that's the case.
I do the same thing. I kind of drift off and it becomes hard to hear. But, yeah, if you could speak up.
I will. House Bill 2305 examines ORS 192525. ORS 192525 is the core provider medical record confidentiality provision and really was the focus of the 104 committee's efforts in looking at how HIPAA affects Oregon law. A group of us in the 104 committee, as well as the health law section of the bar, looked at 192.525 to see what we should do with it in light of HIPAA. It does pose problems under HIPAA. It contains terms that are not consistent with HIPAA. It contains concepts that are not consistent with HIPAA. In the written testimony, I go through section by section and indicate where those problems are. I will not do that to you today. But it was the consensus of the 104 committee that, in fact, 192.525 could not be saved, that amending it to try to insert HIPAA would make it into a piecemeal piece of legislation that would not really accomplish its goal, and so we decided to repeal it and replace it. And what you have in 2305 is the replacement version. And what the replacement version does is it inserts HIPAA concepts into Oregon law. It maintains as much as possible existing Oregon confidentiality policy. It's important to reiterate at this point that the 104 committee tried very hard to only insert HIPAA where we needed to and to maintain as much as possible existing policy. This was not an opportunity, we felt, to go in and revisit decisions that had already been made by the legislature and others about medical record privacy. We wanted to try to make it clear in Oregon what the policy ought to be, what Oregon provides and what HIPAA provides, and not deviate from previous decisions that had been made. So what we did was first we looked at the policy statement that was made in Section 1, subsection 1, found that it had some terms that wouldn't make sense under HIPAA. It had some concepts that were a little an awkward fit under HIPAA, and so we replaced it with another policy statement that is not substantively different than the previous one but is reflective of HIPAA. Then Section 2 is an important section because it defines terms. I'm not going to go through all the terms it defines, but suffice it to say, this was the focus of a lot of effort to make sure the terms we use in this statute are consistent with HIPAA. And so all the definitions that are contained in Section 2 are HIPAA definitions. The amendments that occurred on the House side and that have been the subject of much discussion, not only among the Senate Bill 104 Committee, but also, frankly, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, helped us to identify some inadvertent deviations from HIPAA definitions in the earlier version of this bill. So Section 2 defines terms using HIPAA. Hook, line, and sinker, every comma, everything, so that we don't run into a problem with Oregon law having a slightly different definition of a term than HIPAA does. Section 3 is where you need to focus your attention, in my opinion. Section 3 lays out the confidentiality policy in Oregon. When providers and the state health plan must obtain patient authorization for use and disclosure of what's called protected health information, it's a HIPAA term, think of it as patient information, when you have to get authorization and when you don't. The committee felt it was important to put, we were not trying to write all of HIPAA into state law, but we felt it was important to put in those basic provisions. That section was amended by the House Judiciary Committee to clarify that a patient's health information can be disclosed as required by order of the court in addition to state and federal law. That was a change that was made on the House side and concurred in by the Senate Bill 104 Committee. Section 4 allows providers to charge a reasonable fee for copying health information. That was part of the original 192.525. The language was changed slightly to reflect HIPAA, and it was further amended to make some technical changes on what hospitals and providers and others could actually charge for. There was no opposition or controversy regarding those changes. Section 5 is also an important section. The original 192.525 had an authorization form. That authorization form is not HIPAA compliant. HIPAA contains very specific requirements for what an authorization form must contain. And it's important that we get that right in Oregon because the authorization form is the primary method by which a patient expresses their permission to use and disclose information. So we didn't want to simply repeal the authorization form in 192.525 and leave a vacuum there. So the committee took it upon itself to write another authorization form that is HIPAA compliant. There have been amendments to that form designed to make it more clear and designed to clarify that it is HIPAA compliant. Those amendments were not controversial, and they are supported by the 104 committee. Section.
Say that one more time.
Yes. The authorization form has been worked on extensively. When it was considered by the House Judiciary Committee, there were some who found some areas of the form they felt were not clear enough, that perhaps the form was more complicated than it needed to be. You know, it was drafted by lawyers. And so we made some revisions to it, and that's fine. It is still a HIPAA-compliant form. We think perhaps this is more clear for users, and that was the goal. We wanted to make sure patients can understand it as well as the lawyer.
But those amendments were accomplished in the House.
Yeah, in the House, yes.
They're not new amendments.
There are... yeah, there are new amendments before you that clarify language in the authorization form.
All right. I think the hopefully, I'll, if we have any amendments to these bills, they're going to have to get clearance from Chair Williams. That's my commitment to him. If he doesn't support them, I'm not going to entertain it.
And that's fine.
Unless the committee here thinks that there's another compelling reason to do so, we'll have that discussion later. But I want to not throw all of the work out. David Gaston. That makes sense?
That, Chair Minister, that makes absolute sense, and the amendments that are before you today are not opposed by the 104 committee, but nor are they necessarily proposed by us. They're fine, but they're not something we think are essential. And we will see to whatever process you would like to go through on considering those amendments.
Okay, great.
Section 6 establishes that a health care provider or a state health plan does not breach a confidential relationship with an individual if the provider or plan uses or discloses protected health information in accordance with Section 3 of the Act. Remember that Section 3 is the provision that says when you have to have authorization and when you don't. Section 6 is a response to the court decision in Humphreys v. First Interstate Bank decision in 1985. This is the case that's considered by many, particularly in the physician community and those who represent them, to establish a common law duty to maintain the confidentiality of medical records, including the requirement to obtain patient consent before disclosing patient information.
Now, Senator Ringo.
I just wanted, you said Section 6 or Section 7?
Section 6, but let me make sure I didn't just... I realized that either I had a huge computer goblin or I was very tired as I completed my testimony because some of the latter part of my written testimony is a little bit off. No, it is, in fact, Section 6.
Okay.
Of the ANGROS version, yeah.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes,
and Section 6 overturns the 1985 case.
Senator Ringo, is not intended to overturn the decision, but rather let me clarify that some of the thought process that went into it.
Thank you.
HIPAA does not require that a provider or insurer, for that matter, obtain patient consent before disclosing patient information for treatment, payment, healthcare operations. Now, that is the original version of HIPAA, by the way, did require consent. The revised version of last August removed that requirement. The concern among many is that because the Humphreys decision seems to say that if you do not get patient permission for disclosure of patient information for whatever purpose, that you have created a private right of action for breach of confidentiality. And the concern was that while HIPAA, which is intended to be the law of the land and establish a floor from which states can build in protecting patient information and granting patient rights, essentially would not be effective in Oregon because Humphreys would require a consent. Otherwise, there would be a cause of action against the provider for failure to do that. So the thought was that HIPAA does not require a consent. If we want to make that also law in Oregon, we need to deal with Humphreys.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
What was the context of Humphreys? Was it a collection matter?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, no. It was a woman who had placed her child up for adoption, and then many years later, I think 20 years later, the physician who had been involved in the adoption process, the child was adopted out at birth, released the mother's medical records without any kind of consent from the mother or any kind of authorization, without her knowledge. That was the context of it.
And the court ruled that there was a private cause of action for that disclosure.
Yes, and Senator Ringo, yes. Because the physician had not, there was an expectation of privacy on the part of the mother, and the mother had not provided any kind of permission to the physician to release that information.
And so this bill would specify that there would not be a private cause of action under those circumstances.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, interestingly, not to make this more complicated than it needs to be, in my opinion, that mother would probably still have a cause of action because that release was not for purposes of treatment, payment or health care operations. That physician would still have gotten to have been required to obtain what now would be referred to as authorization, and that mother could still have sued, frankly, because that physician would not have complied with Section 3 of the bill.
So this bill would say there's not a private action for an authorized release, and that those include things like for collection or for treatment, but if there's a release outside of those conditions, then what?
Well, let me clarify, because now we go to Section 7.
Okay.
HIPAA does not contain a private right of action.
Right.
We wanted to make Oregon law consistent with HIPAA. So when we're looking at Section 6, which says there isn't a cause of action if you comply with the law, is essentially what that says. Section 7 says, well, by saying that, we're not trying to imply that there is a cause of action if you don't, because HIPAA does not provide for a private right of action. And it was the goal of the Senate Bill 104 committee to draft Oregon law so that it was consistent with HIPAA. So Section 7 says that nothing in Sections 2 and 3 can be construed to create a private cause of action against a health care provider or a state health plan.
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
I understand that HIPAA isn't intended to create a private cause of action, but I'm wondering whether it prevents a private cause of action in areas not directly addressed by HIPAA.
Chairman and Senator Rio, in my opinion, HIPAA is a permissive bill. It says what you are allowed to do. It does not say what you have to do. I do not believe it prevents Oregon from having a cause of action if it chooses to for policy reasons.
Okay, and it's your opinion that if we pass this bill, under the Humphreys case, there still would have been a private right of action because of the nature of the disclosure.
Let me back up. Senator Ringo, you're posing an interesting question, and so I want to make sure I answer it as thoughtfully as I can. I think you're probably – what I think this bill does is it clarifies that there is not a cause of action under Humphreys if you comply with the law. But it also goes on to say that we're not trying to create a private cause of action against a healthcare provider either. So I think that I think that we are essentially saying that there isn't a private cause of action for breach of confidentiality in Oregon.
You said that there is?
Is not. And I'll invite comments from others who are also involved in this issue.
Okay. And Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
And just so that I'm clear, I understand that the information can be transferred under the circumstances you described, for example, other treatment, but... this bill, according in your opinion, would make it so that there would not be a private right of action, even if there was disclosure, not under those set of circumstances.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, I believe that is correct, but you also have to remember that HIPAA contains extensive enforcement provisions
okay. That
include criminal fines and criminal jail time.
Well, let's talk about that. Maybe
okay. Why
don't you continue, and I don't
sure.
We'll probably get to that one later in the bill then.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think
okay. We
can come back
okay.
to that issue.
Thank
sure.
you.
Section 8 of the bill repeals 192.525 and a related statute. Sections 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14, and 15 are housekeeping provisions designed to incorporate changes made elsewhere into other Oregon provisions. Section 16 incorporates into 2305 the changes to the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure that are recommended by the Oregon Council on Court Procedures. I sat on the subcommittee that developed these changes. I will describe them briefly. It was found that the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, particularly ORCP 55H, are not directly preempted by HIPAA, but that present, quote, traps for the unwary. There are certain HIPAA provisions for subpoenaing of medical records that are not contained in Oregon law. There are provisions of Oregon law that are like some of the HIPAA requirements, but not expressed exactly like HIPAA. So the council felt it would be better to go ahead and amend 55H to state how you're supposed to subpoena medical records in Oregon and incorporate state or federal law into state law so it's clear what you're supposed to do. And this is the amendments were done by a subcommittee that had both defense counsel and plaintiff's counsel. and were consensus documents. So these were inserted into 2305 by the House Judiciary Committee because it is important that these changes be made on the same time frame as the other changes required by HIPAA because they are subject to the same April 14 compliance date. So that's why these have been included into 2305. And that is the end of the bill. And I'm happy to answer other questions that you may have. Oh, except the emergency clause. I apologize. There is an emergency clause on this. The reason for this is because HIPAA, as Senator Bryan indicated, is effective on April 14 of this year. It will be important to have these changes to Oregon law implemented by the compliance date so that we don't have confusion among providers and insurers as to what the law is in Oregon. With that, I appreciate your attention. I know this isn't easy, and I'll take whatever questions you have.
Glenn, could you go back to Section 3?
Sure.
And is this language in Section 3 directly out of the Federal Act?
Chairman, the concepts are directly out of the Federal Act. It is not expressed word for word as it is in HIPAA. If we were to do it word for word as it is in HIPAA, it would be far more lengthy. This is designed to essentially summarize what HIPAA requires regarding use of authorizations, for use and disclosure of information and when authorization is not required. Much of the language is verbatim out of HIPAA, but it's just organized a little bit differently.
Yeah. The language seems kind of loosey-goosey to me, but I'm not a lawyer, so it seems... And this is the compliance section that kicks in Section 6.
Yes, that is true. The key to Section 3, and I understand why it seems... loose, but the key to its precision is not really in the language of Section 3, but in the definitions of terms. Because any time it uses a term like authorization, you go back and look at what is an authorization. Any time it discusses protected health information, you look at what that is. And that is a very defined set of information. So it's the definitions really, and definition of healthcare provider, for example. It's the definitions that really define the scope and intent of Section 3.
Okay, well, help me understand, if I can get this right, subsection 3 of Section 3, you may disclose protected health information of an individual without obtaining authorization from the individual or a personal representative individual, A, to another covered entity for healthcare operations, activities of the entity that receives the information, if... blah, 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 each mm-hmm. entity has or had a relationship mm-hmm. with the individual. What does that mean?
That means that's a fairly recent change to the HIPAA regulations. That is designed to address the question that was posed, that what about a hospital that is wanting to release information to, let's say, a community physician for that community physician's what are called healthcare operations, which are things like quality assurance, any kind of the management needs of the community physician and they're in their practice, could, or better said, even release from one hospital to another of, let's say, registry information, cancer, tumor information, disclosed to another hospital for purposes of their own internal evaluation of those issues and quality assurance and assessment of what that hospital is doing.
Right.
This provision would allow disclosure to that other hospital of, let's say, the cancer tumor information, as if that other hospital has had a relationship with the patient and is using it for their own internal quality assurance and assessment. In the same way, you can release information to a community physician for that physician's payment activities. That used to be a glitch in the law, that if the hospital holds information that the community physician needs in order to obtain payment for services, there would have to be an authorization by the patient before the hospital could release the information because it's not for the hospital's purposes, it's for the community physician's purposes. So that's what that section gets to, perhaps more detail than you wanted. But I know the key to that is the definition of healthcare operations, and I understand why that's confusing.
Well, okay, when it says each entity has or had a relationship, are
right.
we referring back to the definition of covered entity?
Yes. What that means is that when the hospital releases it to another covered entity. I use hospitals because that's where I'm from and that's where I might go for examples. Hospital is a covered entity. They release patient information to another covered entity, which could be a physician, for that physician's treatment payment or healthcare operations. If they can do that, if it's for healthcare operations, the physician has to have had a relationship with the patient before you can release it for that purpose to them.
All right, so the word entity is to be assumed to be covered entity.
Yes.
So why not use the word covered?
That would be fine.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dayton, you indicated, or someone indicated, that I think it was Mr. Bryant, that we're all going to be getting notices about HIPAA and the changes. And I'm just in listening to the comments of the chair, I'm just a little concerned. Are those notices going to be uniform from one provider to the next?
Chairman and Senator Walker, generally, yes. What you're referring to, I believe, is a notice of privacy practices. And what that is a notice that is required of all providers, that is given to the patient as of the first date of service, that explains to the patient the privacy practices of the, let's say, hospital or physician. So we can walk this through. You go into the hospital. They will give you their notice of privacy practices. You will then be asked to acknowledge that you have received it, and you will sign that you have received it. The hospitals also require end physician to post the notice of privacy practices in a place that you will see it. HIPAA contains very express provisions for what must be in this notice of privacy practices. They are very express. They are very precise. And the Hospital Association has developed a model notice, so has the American Hospital Association and others. To a large extent, the privacy notices you receive will look like each other because they all have, they need to have certain provisions explaining what HIPAA requires, not just what the hospital is going to do, but what HIPAA requires, explaining where Oregon law might have different provisions or provide different rights. That needs to be explained. All patient rights under HIPAA need to be explained in the notice of privacy practices. So privacy notices will, in large part, be the same. You may see the physicians look a little different than the hospitals because, in most circumstances, the hospital's notice will cover not only the hospital but the physicians practicing there, so that when the physician goes to the hospital to see their patient, they don't have to carry a suitcase of privacy notices and give them out. They can rely on the hospital's notice of privacy practices, and the hospital's notice will inform the patient of that. This covers the activities of the physician in this hospital. So there'll be those sort of deviations. But I think in large part they will look similar.
Are we dealing with that in any of these bills about the notice requirement, or is that something that HIPAA just is requiring and we're doing that without statutory regulation?
Chairman and Senator Walker, the Notice of Privacy Practices is not dealt with in 2305. I believe it is dealt with in 2306, so that's not my area of expertise when it comes to these bills. The reason it's not dealt with in 2305, frankly, is the 104 Committee tried to amend provisions of Oregon law that were parallel to HIPAA. So we're not creating traps for the unwary, so that Oregon law was consistent with HIPAA. You could comply with Oregon law and know that you were not out of compliance with federal law. But areas where Oregon law didn't have a parallel provision, and the notice of privacy practices won, there's no existing requirement that there be a notice of privacy practices, we're letting HIPAA be the law of the land and stand as the law of the land. Patient rights is another area. You'll notice that there are extensive patient rights in HIPAA, rights to access to their information, right to amend, and we could go on and on. And they are a core part of HIPAA, and nobody thinks they're not important. But Oregon law does not have any kind of parallel provision that needs to be amended or fixed to reflect HIPAA. So we're letting HIPAA stand as the law, not necessarily writing it into Oregon law. In the same way that extensive Medicare regulations aren't written into Oregon law, there's federal patients' rights that aren't written into Oregon law. I mean, there's lots of federal law that stands alone, and there are HIPAA provisions that are also standing alone.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, and I'll take a look at 2306 when we get it, because I just have some concerns about the noticing, and I appreciate your explanation.
Sure.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions were also about the noticing, so I'll wait for the next bill.
All right.
Sure.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you a couple questions. One is on Section 4. Says the healthcare provider or state health plan may charge a reasonable cost-based fee to cover the cost of essentially providing records.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if there was discussion as to what is considered to be a reasonable cost-based fee.
Chairman and Senator Ringo. There was not, because this is existing Oregon law. And we basically just used existing Oregon law, inserting additional HIPAA provisions that talk about covering the cost of copying and postage. And so there was some additional HIPAA language, but we didn't try to revisit the original decision made by those who passed 192.525 to allow for reasonable cost. We did try to make sure it was limited in the way that HIPAA limits it.
Okay. To say that it's allowed that they charge a reasonable cost doesn't explicitly say that they are precluded from charging an unreasonable cost. And I'm wondering whether you interpret it that way.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, I don't think I interpret it that way. Allowing charge of a reasonable charge, I think, inherently implies you cannot charge more than is reasonable.
Okay. And you would interpret this to mean that somebody is prevented from charging a reasonable cost?
Chairman or Senator Ringo, certainly I would. And remember that Oregon law also does not allow a provider to refuse to provide a copy of something because the patient cannot afford it. So if a patient requests information to be copied and the patient demonstrates they cannot afford the cost of copying, the hospital and, I believe, physician provide the copy anyway.
Maybe the comment wasn't the question. I mean, just in my law practice, when we request medical records, there's a wide variety of charges. And I've seen situations where physicians have charged $50 for two or three pages that I find outrageous and certainly unreasonable. And I'm wondering what would you suggest that the patient do when faced with that kind of bill?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, frankly, that's an issue that is precedes HIPAA and precedes this bill.
It's of interest to me, though, and the bill addresses this subject, and that's why I'm asking you about it.
It's kind of like a deer when your deer hunt is right in front of you, guys.
Pardon?
So shoot it or you're not.
Let me reiterate what I said before, that frankly the committee didn't take that on because it's not a HIPAA-related issue. We didn't want to deviate from what previous legislators have already decided needed to be in Oregon law, and previous legislators did not decide that there needed to be an express elaboration on what is a reasonable charge. But that, I can also say, however, that that would now be a HIPAA violation.
Okay.
And the person who is aggrieved could certainly complain, and the Department of Human Services, Federal Department of Health and Human Services, would go in and investigate and try and assess the person, either a fine or whatever was appropriate.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So let's talk about the penalties for violation.
Mm-hmm.
What are those?
Let me refer to my manual.
Thank you.
And that raises an interesting question, too. If we're not changing the prior law, if this the Section 4 that Senator Ringo raised with respect to the reasonable fees, if you did charge an unreasonable fee, do these fines and or penalties kick in?
Sure, Minister, they should, because HIPAA allows charge a reasonable fee. And if that fee was objectively unreasonable...
Right. We know what objectively and reasonable is.
I can't tell you that.
Because it's objective.
So, I mean, I think that makes Senator Ringo's point more salient, that if the fines and penalties kick in for violation, it seems to me that we ought to clarify what a violation would be. I mean, I think
Chairman, the difficulty with that is HIPAA doesn't clarify. And so
we can say
we've always been able to say, pre-HIPAA or now, we can say what we deem to be reasonable.
Right. Right. Okay.
If there is a charge that you feel is unreasonable, here's how it works. Enforcement of HIPAA is complaint-driven. Currently, the Department of Health and Human Services indicated that they are not going to affirmatively go out and investigate for HIPAA violations. But if there is a complaint, they will assess whether a violation has occurred.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, they will assess.
The Federal Department of Health and Human Services, the Office for Civil Rights, more specifically.
Okay.
The enforcement mechanism of this is this: if you have been found in violation of a HIPAA privacy regulations, first of all, it's the Office of Civil Rights that's responsible for enforcing them. The fines are this. So this is the progression.
$100 per patient per violation, up to a maximum, and there's more, of $25,000 of an identical requirement or prohibition during a single calendar year. The penalty cannot be imposed if the violation was due to reasonable cause and not willful neglect, and was corrected within 30 days of the time a person using reasonable diligence would have known about it. You make a mistake, you fix it, didn't cause harm, okay. However, if you knowingly violated HIPAA, not more than $50,000 or not more than 1 year in prison. If under false pretenses you disclose patient health information or otherwise violate HIPAA, not more than $100,000 and not more than 5 years in prison. If you knowingly sell private information for compensation, not more than $250,000 and not more than 10 years in prison. That's the enforcement progression.
Karen? Yes, go ahead.
Is there any private enforcement mechanism?
No. HIPAA does not provide a private right of action. However, it does provide for individual complaint to the department, and in fact requires that the notice of privacy practices that Senator Walker mentioned earlier contain indication of that right and contact information in the notice of privacy practices where somebody can call and make a complaint.
Mr. Chairman, this is kind of obviously HIPAA is going to do what it's going to do without a lot of input from us. It's just that I don't think an enforcement mechanism has much teeth if we're relying on a bureaucracy in the federal government that requires funding from the feds, et cetera, et cetera. Those penalties sound pretty impressive, but I just don't see them having any teeth in terms of really preventing this conduct.
And I think you raise an interesting question, just because there is a federal penalty, I don't know that that would preclude the state from taking some action.
Chairman and Senator Ringo, the state currently, and I'll invite comment from others who may disagree, but I don't believe the state currently has dual enforcement provision, enforcement authority for HIPAA. Certainly, I know the Department of Human Services has adopted extensive rules to implement HIPAA, and they would have the authority, I would imagine, under their existing statutory and rulemaking authority to penalize for violation of their own rules. So that may exist. But I don't believe that the Department of Human Services here in Oregon will have broad umbrella authority to independently enforce HIPAA or penalize for a HIPAA violation that is not otherwise a violation of state law or state rules. There's one other comment I was going to make, and let me... now it's escaping me. I'm sure it'll come to me after I've left.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any other comments?
Chairman,
Senator Breed.
Well, I agree with you and Senator Ringo. I would really be interested in finding out how we could do, maybe not as draconian, but maybe even some private cause of action for violation at the state level so that people have a recourse, especially in the case of medical information being sold or willfully given away. That's a very big concern. I don't think we can count on, in this budget climate particularly, I don't think we can count on the federal government to necessarily move against all these cases.
Senator Burdick, I don't want to belabor this, but I will close by saying that I know, because I'm coordinating the HIPAA compliance work for the hospitals, that hospitals, and I know the same is true of physicians, are working very hard to ensure that they are HIPAA compliant. Nobody is taking this lightly. Nobody is thinking they can go ahead and violate HIPAA because perhaps they won't get caught, or if they do, it's not that big of a deal. Nobody has that feeling. Nobody has that attitude at all. So there certainly is not that sense. And I would add that, frankly, if somebody sells patient information, the federal government will not take that lightly. All indications we've gotten from them and their commentary are that that's a very serious offense, and they are taking it very seriously. I understand your concerns, but I can tell you that HIPAA is not being taken lightly either by the federal government or by those who must implement it in Oregon.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Sufficiently highlighted issues. This bill, so we'll move into a discussion about 2306. And who's the presenter here?
I think. Oh.
Okay, can you just introduce yourself for the record? And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Molly Burns Herman. I'm an attorney with Kaiser Permanente, but I'm here today in my role as a member of the Health Plan Subcommittee that was formed under the Senate Bill 104 Committee to help advise them on certain issues, as well as I advise some of the members of the committee. And I'm here to talk about House Bill 2306. I will just add, since there are a couple comments about being able to be heard, I don't think it'll be a problem. I've literally had people move off the same floor of my building because I'm too loud, but do let me know if this is the first time that this would ever happen to me. Also, I'd like to add that there are other members of the Senate Bill 104 Committee here to aid in answering any questions, so I may defer to them as well, but hopefully I'll be able to answer all your questions as well as go through the bill. With regard to House Bill 2306, let me say that I with your permission, I'm not going to go through this too detailed. You'll see just flipping through the Angros bill if you have it. Much of this is very dry. Much of it is correcting a number of existing statutes within the insurance code. So a lot of it is just doing some cleanup work and numerology, frankly. So I won't go through it unless you ask me to do that with that sort of detail. And let me then just reiterate and kind of set 2306 within the context, and as set out in the testimony, that 2306 was the work product of the Senate Bill 104 Committee. What it intended to do was encapsulate and address the revisions, address the recommendations of the Senate Bill 104 Committee with respect to the state insurance code. As previous speakers have indicated, of the many policy decisions made by the Senate Bill 104 Committee, one of those decisions was to try and make precise decisions and recommendations about revising, if necessary, Oregon law in connection with Oregon law as it exists now, as opposed to wholesale creating a whole new aspect of Oregon law just devoted to HIPAA. So since the insurance code, as I'll explain in more detail, since our state insurance code already had many parallel or similar or different provisions that are addressed in HIPAA, we really tried to put together in one bill the work that we needed to do that was recommended by the committee with regard to the insurance code. So that's why this is separated out as it is. I also want to mention a couple of the things before going through the bill that reflect the difference of 2306. The objectives of the Senate Bill 104 Committee, which I think are met through House Bill 2306, involve addressing and resolving any preemption issues. Again, there is quite a bit, as we'll explain in detail, the insurance code that really does dovetail or butt up against HIPAA. So we really needed to examine very closely, is some of this Oregon state law preempted? Is it not? If you can't tell, what do we do about that? So we tried to address and resolve the preemption issues. We also tried to achieve consistency with HIPAA and adopt appropriate terminology to enable readers, practitioners, and most importantly, of course, the patients and consumers who will feel the impact of these bills, make them be able to understand and have appropriate, consistent, compliant practices. And one of the things I want to mention that's a little bit different for those covered by 2306, they're actually As a couple people explained, Senator Bryant particularly, while there were some options about whether to do, with respect to HIPAA, whether to do nothing, just let the federal law of the land stay, whether to completely incorporate HIPAA, although you still have these confusions and points of unclarity, so what do you do then? So we chose a middle-of-the-road path to kind of precisely identify where we needed some clarity and address those. With regard to the insurance code, we actually had to do this time. We didn't have that many other options because right now in the insurance code, there are provisions that it is simply not clear to carriers in particular what sort of notices are supposed to be issued in light of HIPAA, but also in light of two underlying schemes that support our insurance law, and that's Gramm-Leach-Bliley and the NAIC Model Privacy Act, and I'll talk just a little bit about them. It's not clear at all, given the existing law in the state and the federal HIPAA law, what notices should be issued to whom, when, how often, such that mostly importantly, the consumers, the readers of these notices were going to get nothing. They were maybe going to be bombarded. They were going to get inconsistent information about what their rights were, and it was simply going to be an untenable situation for all concerned. So we really needed to have some clarity about how the notice, among other elements of these privacy rights, how the notice should go forward, and we needed to do it this year. Secondly, with respect to insurance code, with all good intentions, the last legislature tried to anticipate HIPAA and, in fact, put in a provision in the insurance code right now that delegates authority to the Director of Consumer Business Services Insurance Division, so to the DCBS, to promulgate rules about how to resolve these differences that they anticipated from HIPAA. Unfortunately, the way it happened was not a proper delegation of authority. And the Senate Bill 104 committee was advised by legislative counsel that, in fact, it was a flawed element, existing element of the statute, and could not be enforced, and, in fact, should be ridded from the statute as soon as possible. So we had a problem that needed immediate cleanup that, in fact, took away the only possible solution we had to try and resolve the inconsistencies or the confusion between federal and state law. So with respect to the entities covered under House Bill 2306, we really did have even less limited options about how to proceed. We had to come up with a scheme that would work now so that we could be directed how to communicate with consumers. So 2306 also grants proper authority to DCBS to promulgate rules, and that's where, in fact, we think quite a bit of the subject matters that still maybe need treatment, need to be addressed, need to be discussed, need further policy decisions. Where much of that will happen is at the rulemaking level with the DCBS with regard to those covered by the DCBS, namely carriers. So that delegation of authority has occurred. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Before you go on, in the rulemaking for DCBS, would they have, because my question before was, these are very complex requirements, and the previous speaker said that, you know, different carriers, different hospitals may have different disclosure forms. However, they would all have to contain the same elements. Does this rulemaking authority of DCBS allow them to just adopt a template form that people would have to use to make sure that everybody's getting the same form?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, can I just ask a point of clarification? Are you talking about the notice? Because there are a number of other forms.
Excuse me, I'm talking about the notice, yes.
Thank you very much. Chairman, Senator Burdick, while I want to speak carefully, I don't want to impose on DCBS something I have no right to impose upon them. I believe that by the authority granted in 2306, they would have the authority to do a number of things. I assume producing a template form would be well within their authority. Let me add, though, that being part of that rulemaking process, I think at least entities, and I will speak for others, may try and suggest some flexibility, which is an element I want to talk a little bit about, just because many of the entities who must comply with HIPAA have different fact situations. They relate to their consumers maybe in a different way. Like my organization, we are both a carrier and a provider, so we have to follow different elements of HIPAA. So I think through the rulemaking process, there would be an attempt to have some flexibility with a template form so that we can make it accurate. But I believe, back to your original question, I believe that it would be well within the authority granted under 2306 to issue something like that.
Then my follow-up question, because I'm concerned with the complexity of this, that you know, if consumers are sitting there getting any number of different notices, with, you know, one might be one page, one might be five pages, and whether, you know, my original question was, did you contemplate in the bill just requiring a template form be adopted, but I hear you now saying that there are cases where some flexibility is necessary.
Yes, we believe that to be so. Let me say a couple things. One is this is actually, as difficult as it is, been a very collaborative process here in the state of Oregon, which I think is to our credit. Between examining what people are doing in Oregon as well as nationally, I've never heard of a notice of privacy practices of, I think, less than 8 pages. I think I heard somebody did 5 pages, but it was front and back, and the font was so small as to literally when it was announced, people all laughed. So I think that because of the requirements of HIPAA, while there will be some differences, I think actually the HIPAA Notice of Privacy Practice is going to end up looking quite similar. I wish I had mine because I have it out in the car because I could show it to you, and I think there actually has been a lot of that sharing of information, people showing what their notices look like in this state so that we can try and have it be useful. Let me add one other thing, which is unique to the carrier's position as opposed to the provider's with regard to our notice of privacy practices. The reason why it's complicated is consumers are also going to receive, and already have been receiving, a notice of privacy practices with regard to their financial and insurance information under Gramm-Leach-Bliley. One of the elements we thought here in the state of Oregon presented us an opportunity was to delegate authority to the DCBS to be able to promulgate rules whereby, if appropriate, and if DCBS thinks that it is completely compliant, a carrier that might have to issue a notice of privacy practices because of Gramm-Leach-Bliley also has to issue a notice of privacy practices because of HIPAA might be able to combine the two so that for the reader, we think, makes it a much better usable document so that they understand and they aren't just round filing every dang notice that they have been receiving. So this is exactly the flexibility that we hope to find in the rulemaking process so that we look for opportunities to make it less complex and more useful for the consumer patient.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. And thank you for that explanation, because as I'm sitting here listening and I've started receiving all of those Gramm-Leach-Bliley things, and I round file them because I know what they say, but I'm just worried that it's going to scare the hell out of people when they start getting these long forms about their health care and what does this mean, and there's going to be a lot of questions. So it's got to be as simple as possible and as uniform as possible, because I don't want to have to be in the position of, I have several healthcare providers, as probably do many others, of viewing each form to make sure, well, you have subtle differences in yours because you're a OBGYN, and you have subtle differences in yours because you're a dentist or whatever. I mean, there's got to be some uniformity, and I think that's what Senator Burdick and the rest of us are looking for.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, I hear what you're saying, and I guess just a couple of comments. Because the HIPAA requirements in the Notice of Privacy Practice are so detailed and specific and extensive, it makes the notice that lengthy, 8 pages. I'm just going to pick that number because that's been the most common number. It makes it that lengthy, despite our best efforts to make it shorter. And because, frankly, of the cost and the complexity and the questions it drives, I don't know of any entities that are willing to go over lengths if they can possibly avoid it. With regard to questions, I think that one of the aspects that the entities are looking at is trying to prepare their organizations as well as their providers, and again doing a lot of the collaboration I've referred to try and be able to answer as many of the questions as possible. But where those questions are not being well answered, again, we think that possibly the rulemaking process through DCBS will be the place where we can then resolve outstanding issues that just are persistent and don't seem to be able to go away.
All right, thank you.
So,
hang on just one second for the committee. I'm trying to manage the time here. Floor session is at 11. Normally we stop our work at 10. So I'm wondering if the committee has the ability to stay beyond 10 or we have any commitments.
I have commitments at 10. 10:15, 10:30.
All right. I think given that, then what we're going to do, because we're clearly not going to get through all of this today, we'll try to get through as much as we can. I'm going to slip into a work session on Senate Bill 70, since I've been told the amendments are apparently correct and ready. And then if we don't get through the bills on Thursday, we'll bring them back on Monday so that we'll have a chance to air. I'd like to get through as many of the issues as I can. I know we've got fellow from the Oregon Travelers Association who'd like to have a chance to speak today, too. So hopefully this isn't too convoluted in its process, but trying to manage their time. If you could just bear with me for just a second, close the public hearing on these bills. We'll open a public or continue a work session on Senate Bill 70. Alfred Taylor.
Chairman of the Committee, Senate Bill 70 comes to you from the Juvenile Code Revision Guardianship Project of the Oregon Law Commission. You have the dash two amendments in front of you. This bill relates to guardianship, creates a procedure for establishing guardianship in juvenile courts. You have the dash two amendments, and they address the issues that were raised at the last meeting. For example, there was a question raised about the term competent evidence. The evidence code, one would assume that all evidence that comes in is competent, and using the word twice causes ambiguity and could mean something different that was in the evidence code. The certain other provisions were moved around for the purposes of clarity. You have the Oregon Law Commission here today, and you have Lisa Kay and Kim Travis. I understand the amendments also reduce the fiscal impact from about $60,000 to about $26,000.
And is there is no subsequent referral?
No, Mr. Chair, there is not.
All right, good. So, all right, and Ms. Kay has been very kind in dealing with my demands that they reorganize and restructure so that it's more readable. We did visit in the past. I think we've gotten substantially there, so it's readable and it's a nice form. So if I could entertain an adoption of the dash two amendment.
Senator Brady. I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 70.
All right, Senator Brady moves the adoption of the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 70. Are there any discussion comments? You want to take just a second and make sure you have them?
Yeah, I don't. I have the draft
incorporating,
but I don't have the distinct
amendments
to the dash two.
I'm sorry,
I have those available. So I have
those. Council Taylor.
Two copies of the dash one.
We have a hand.
Yeah, we've got the draft incorporated.
Oh.
Well, we are, and you know, I think the issues that we heard on for this committee had to do with the competent evidence terminology, and then just the structure of how the bill was written. And I visited with Ms. Kay. I thought they've done a pretty remarkable job going back and restructuring things so it's just more readable to laypersons and hopefully practitioners. Too, so. It's one of those things where I know they all understood what they were doing, but it wasn't clear. That
are you looking for a motion to move
it? I'm hoping to.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. With a flying leap, Senate Bill 70 as amended right. To the Senate floor with a recast recommendation.
So Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the dash two amendments.
I did that.
I
don't think we actually
okay,
did.
Well, we have discussion. Any objections to the adoption? None. Thank you. Senator Brady now moves Senate Bill 70 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. So leap of faith, however, comma. If something comes up between now and then, let me know. We can bring it back if there's a problem. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none. Thank you very much. And I will carry this puppy since I sent them down that path.
Completely right.
Yeah. All right. We'll reopen the public hearing on 230567 and 9. And you want to continue?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will try and be brief. I simply do want to mention the one last thing, which we've kind of addressed, but just to emphasize it, that one of the other objectives that became from the Senate Bill 104 Committee was with regard to the insurance code, to try and avoid any trash of the unwary in the insurance code as we achieve consistency with HIPAA, given that underlying in our insurance code are two other, among many, statutory schemes. One is Graham Leach Bliley, and the other is the Model NAIC Privacy Act. Oregon, not surprisingly, again, is kind of ahead of the curve and had quite a number of these privacy protections already in our state statute that HIPAA either in some cases duplicates or parallels or is an apple to the orange. So what we tried to do was preserve the existing state statutory scheme and yet make it conform to HIPAA where necessary, or if it was not clear to us or it appeared to indicate the need for rulemaking or further policy decisions, then we would grant authority to the DCBS to continue that work. And we believe House Bill 2306 has achieved that. I will now, with your permission, go quickly through the bill, and then if there's and then answer questions if there's time. I can mention the OTLA amendments, and then there's two other short amendments. And I think this will be brief. In House Bill 2306A engrossed, actually the meat of this bill now really is found in sections 1, 2, 3, and 4. And what that does is this is all new language in our state statute that basically either repeats or summarizes, or in some cases, according to our wise legislative counsel, better states HIPAA law as it applies to covered entities that are covered by the insurance code, namely, in this case, health carriers, health insurers, and there are other elements of that defined term. And what it seeks to do is to set out the basic obligations under HIPAA that you may not, that a covered entity, in this case a health insurer, may not use or disclose PHI without an authorization or only then in accordance with certain permitted uses, and it lists those out. Further, it goes on to set out what the rights are of the individuals under HIPAA and in fact, many of which already existed under state law, and that is the right of access to one's own PHI amendment and now new a right to have an accounting of any disclosures of one PHI and certain other rights, rights to request restrictions, rights to make a complaint. There are a number of these rights. I can go through them in detail if need be. And then in Section 4 is, again, the final part, which we think is entirely critical to the scheme, and that is that the DCBS is granted appropriately, constitutionally, authority to adopt rules under this section to not only to conform a state statute with HIPAA, but also in connection with federal Graham Leach Bliley and NAIC Model Act. There are a few places where our state statutes are more strict with regard to privacy practices than the federal HIPAA law, and we don't want to lose that or eliminate that because that is a scheme already adopted by previous legislatures and not within our authority to overturn. After Section 4, frankly, although, again, I'm happy to go through this, the rest of the bill, the rest of the 24 pages of the bill, much of that is just correcting terminology, is just to give you an example, the terminology on the state statute, because of the previous NAIC Model Act and Graham Leach Bliley, used terms that were distinct from HIPAA but sort of the same thing. So, for example, we talked in state law about protecting personal information, or we talked about protecting medical records. Well, neither of those terms are an exact match with PHI, personal health information, protected health information under HIPAA. So we wish to, at SB 104 committee's decision, to adopt what terminology we need to do to make it clear. And so what we've done is fixed a lot of the terminology in our state laws through the rest of this bill. Also, so there's a lot of terminology fixing. Also, because we couldn't get around that health insurers covered under HIPAA are different from life insurers or property and casualty insurers or other insurers, surplus lines, that are covered under the insurance code, namely Chapter 746, but are not covered under HIPAA. We're trying to figure out a way to sensibly address the distinctions and yet maintain the authority of the insurance code and the insurance division over health insurers for the remaining part of Chapter 746 that health insurers still must comply with. So what we've done is we've eliminated health insurer from part of the insurance code and put it over into another part of the insurance code for purposes of conforming to HIPAA. It's really just moving things around, but it takes a lot of words to do that, and that's what quite a bit of the rest of this bill is, too. Again, not trying to go over it too quickly, but that's a lot of what's going on. And, in fact, unless you need me to stop before, what I'd like to do is actually go to the near the end of the bill where we get to Section 18 of the bill, which refers to ORS 746.680. This is the one other element that, again, needed very particular precise attention because, as has been spoken earlier here in this committee, there was a lot of concern about what is an individual's rights of action should there be violations of these laws. Well, existing in Oregon insurance state law right now, there are private rights of action for an individual against, and I'm going to only talk about health insurers because we're talking about the impact of HIPAA. I'm not going to talk about property and casualty and those folks. There is right now a private right of action under ORS 746.680. The private right of action is based on a certain type of set of violations set out in the code, and the damages for any liability established there under is capped or limited or defined. It was not the intent or policy, or certainly we did not inadvertently want to change those rights or eliminate or decrease them. Yet also we wanted to make sure to not, again, inadvertently expand that private right of action so that it bootstrapped in all of HIPAA or, in fact, some other extension that is beyond the scope of state law in existence right now. So Section 18 of this Act goes through and seeks to do that. And what it does say is that under the insurance code, for violations of the insurance code as amended with HIPAA, and particularly the violation of the rights of an individual to access or amend or delete their PHI or to have limits put on the use and disclosure of PHI such that it may only be used and disclosed in accordance with the law. For violations of those elements, then there is a private right of action by an individual against the health insurer entity committing that violation, and then it talks about how that action has to be brought forth. It has to there are limits on the damages, and you may either seek equitable, you can only seek equitable remedies for certain violations. And I can go through that line by line again, but I wanted to touch on those because of the importance of it, and then the discussion earlier about whether people have individual rights of action, and they will against carriers, both as the state law currently allows and in connection with the HIPAA rights that the state law subsumes.
I think what I'm going to do is cut you off at this point. So I want to get remarks by the folks from the Trial Lawyers Association. We've got about 12 minutes left, and that's probably not sufficient time. But I want to at least get them on and honor the fact that they're here. We'll bring these bills back on Thursday and kind of pick up where we left off and plod through them until we hopefully come to a resolution.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. All right, trial lawyers. Folks, I forget your name. I apologize. I know you've been in front of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, Richard Lane on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. The Oregon Trial Lawyers Association opposed the whole package of, quote, HIPAA bills on the House side. And the reason for that opposition is a fundamental policy decision that the SB 104 committee made. Okay, we've heard an awful lot this morning about notice provisions and other rights and obligations under HIPAA. None of those rights and obligations are incorporated in this package of bills. Okay? That's the fundamental problem that we have now if we adopt 2305, 6, and 7. A patchwork of state and federal laws and a trap for somebody who tries to figure out just what
protected health information can be disclosed, and how do you make sure that you're complying with HIPAA law? HIPAA law on April 14th is the law of the nation. It sets, in my mind, sort of the floor. Okay, so any state that had laws regarding disclosures that was below that floor, those are preempted by the federal law. They're out, gone. Nobody has to do anything. Nobody has to change anything. Nobody has to amend anything. They're gone because HIPAA says what the floor is. Now, HIPAA makes clear that state statutes that afford greater protection live in harmony with HIPAA. They are not preempted. So any state is free to afford greater protection than that set out by HIPAA. So when we spoke briefly about Section 6 and Section 7 and 2305, that was a point of opposition on the House side. There is no reason why existing current law, as the Humphreys case that we talked about, which was a disclosure case improperly, that a private right of action cannot survive HIPAA implementation. It provides greater protection. Now, Senator Burdick and Senator Walker, to a certain extent, started talking about notice provisions and standardization so that we'd have a simple form that everybody could respond to. Well, there's nothing in 2305 that's going to do anything about the notice provisions. And the reason for that is because on 2305, the rights to notice that are articulated in HIPAA, that are the law of the land, are not incorporated in 2305. And that was a policy choice that the SB 104 committee choice made. Now, I made a list in a previous hearing on the House side. The HIPAA regulations are contained in 45 CFR 160 and 164. And you can read them. They're CFR regulations, so they're dry. I'll be the first to admit that. But 45 CFR 164.520 sets out the rights of notice that anybody is entitled to that has protected health information. 45 CFR 164.522 sets out the right to request that certain privacy information be restricted. 45 CFR 164.525 provides a right of access for any individuals. 45 CFR 164.526 talks about the right to an amendment of any protected health information. You can go in, you can look at your chart, and you can change it. 45 CFR 164.528 talks about a listing, an accounting of all disclosures. You as an individual can find out where your information has gone. It's not included in 2305. None of those rights are included in 2305. If you turn, I know we're tight on time, and I know this is not going to be the last day on this, but if you look at House Bill 2306, those rights that I was just talking about are set out in Section 2. But note on line 9 that those rights that are being discussed there apply only to health insurers. And that was a policy choice. If you look at 2305, the rights and responsibilities for notice, disclosure, restriction, amendment, accounting, they don't apply to health care providers under 2305 because the proponents decided not to. So what we have, if the committee's wisdom, these bills should move forward, is you're going to have a set of Oregon statutes that set out certain protections, rights, obligations under HIPAA, but not all. And inside that statutory scheme, there's no reference in any of these bills to the corresponding federal rule, 45 CFR 160-164. So you're going to have a patchwork in order to ensure that people live up to the obligations of HIPAA and don't inadvertently disclose improperly protected health information.
Senator Burdick.
I think, Mr. Chairman, it's your concern because, as you point out, we're under preemption, the federal law is the law where Oregon law is less protective, but where Oregon law is more protective than Oregon law dominates over the federal law. Is your concern that if it's not specifically mentioned, in other words, the places where we're not more protective than HIPAA, by not incorporating it, is your concern that there would not be a cause of action under state statute? Is that what you're concerned about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, there's a couple of things that I'm concerned about wound inside your question, and certainly the denial of the private cause of action for a violation of state law is removed from an individual if these bills are passed. Section 6 and Section 7 would take care of that. That right would be eliminated. That's a concern. My other concern is that if somebody, an attorney or a medical provider or anybody, an individual, looked at the Oregon revised statutes, they might be fooled into believing that if they did what the statute said, they'd be in HIPAA compliance, when in fact they would not in certain situations, because HIPAA requires certain additional obligations that have not been engrafted into state law. That was the policy choice that the SB 104 committee made. They decided to look at only laws in Oregon that were directly impacted by the HIPAA rules and try to meld those, and then omitted anything that Oregon statutes didn't speak to. And you can see the difference between 2305 and 2306, where there are certain obligations on health insurers under Oregon statutes that need to be, apparently by rulemaking authority, worked through, and how they operate under the HIPAA rights and regulations. But the health care providers, they're only looking at that authorization statute, Section 3, that Senator Minnis walked through with the covered entity definition. They've omitted the rest of the rights and obligations under HIPAA.
Do you think a solution might be to maybe add sections to these bills incorporating by reference the HIPAA standards that aren't addressed in the scope of this bill?
I, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I certainly think that would be an improvement on the bills. And since the House committee hearings, I have met with a number of the individuals, and some of the dash amendments that you may see or have seen or they are a product of those discussions. So they have taken some of my suggestions during this process. I think that some reference to the corresponding federal HIPAA rights and obligations would be an improvement.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that if you've got the federal requirements anyway, and if there's a way we can make this simpler to people, it seems like there is some room for compromise here to at least put everything in one place.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, we remain willing to work with the proponents of the bill. I just would take issue with the word simple. The word simple does not exist when you start talking about the HIPAA rights and obligations. Take a moment and step back. I think I had the numbers. The initial notice and comment procedures were in November of 1999 for the federal regulation that eventually became the HIPAA product. There were 52,000 comments to the proposed rule received. Amendments and modifications were issued. There was an additional notice and comment period, and in excess of 11,400 comments to what became the final privacy rule was received. So there's an awful lot of issues and different stakeholders in this whole can that had something to say to what became the final HIPAA rule. And it may be complicated, but that is April 15, 2003, the law of the land, and that is what we're all going to be looking for to make sure that we're protecting people's privacy information. I mentioned briefly 6 and 7. I see no reason why Section 6 and 7 should remain in the bills. Even if you were trying to bring clarification to Oregon disclosure law and selecting part of HIPAA, There's no reason why you have to eliminate the Humphers versus First Interstate privacy right that Oregonians have now. It is not inconsistent, not preempted with any of the federal rules. I think I addressed Senator Walker's question earlier about the uniformity of a simple notice. These bills don't address that. Whatever is going to be received by an Oregonian regarding his or her rights under HIPAA is going to come from the federal level, because there's nothing in any of these package of bills that addresses that. It's just omitted from this package. I've referred you to the difference between 2306 on insurers and health care providers. I think that what we have here is the potential for a false sense of security, that somebody who reviews these provisions is going to feel that he is in HIPAA compliance. That's just not going to be the case. There's no reason to take away the privacy protection rights that Oregonians hold right now under existing Oregon law. So I would urge you to delete Section 6 and 7 from the bills if they're going to go forward.
But 6 and 7 of which bill?
23, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, 2305, Section 6 and 7 refer to the overruling of Humphers versus First Interstate, and the Section 7 language about the construction of a private right of action in 2305. I can get Senator Burdick a reference to the 2306, and if there is one in 2307, I just don't have that in front of me right now, but 6 and 7 and 2305.
Okay. And we're running out of time. I want to ask one question of counsel. I'm not an attorney, but where Humphers, if I understand correctly, identified a private right of action that existed in common law.
Correct.
Can we as a legislature reverse that?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're on safe ground here in doing that. And, I mean, it'll be a policy decision as to whether we want to or don't want to. What I'm going to ask the folks to do is, I want to see if we can't get a section by section analysis from the folks that presented today, Gwen, just a section by section by section of each bill. And then what I'd like you to do is, I want you to do the same, stating your objections, if you can, as simply as you can, so that the committee can then kind of line up each section where the 104 group did what they did, made decisions, et cetera, and then where you dissent or agree.
Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear in my charge, some of my objections to what's in the bill now would be what's omitted, and I would just make a reference. You might not see it for comparison side by side. It would be under HIPAA law and omitted from the 2305.
That's fine. Then why don't you footnote that? And we can address it. I go section by section and address it. And then this committee is going to have to either agree or disagree with the work of the 104 committee to find whether or not we can come to agreement or not.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, we are adjourned.